Hello and welcome to the 538 Politics Podcast. I'm Galen Druk, and it's time for another exit interview, so step into my HR office. As a general rule, we don't interview candidates while they're running for president, unless, of course, we run into them at the airport. As listeners may remember, that happened with Andrew Yang. There are various reasons why we don't do those interviews, but a big one is that it can be hard to get candidates who are actively seeking the presidency to be candid. But once they're out of the race, things change. So we like to think of these exit interviews as an opportunity for candidates to be reflective and more candid once the nomination is no longer on the line. And here with me to do that today is Congressman Tim Ryan from Ohio's 13th District, who dropped out of the Democratic primary race last week. Welcome to the podcast.
Thanks for having me.
So there are now 17 or 18 candidates left vying for the nomination, depending on how you count. For starters, Representative Ryan, why are you leaving the race?
Ran out of money.
Fair enough.
Yeah, I just didn't have enough money to keep going, you know, and I wasn't going to hang on if I didn't have a realistic opportunity to pull it out. So that was that. You know, we were doing well on the ground. You know, we were retailing a lot in New Hampshire and South Carolina in particularly, but we couldn't get enough boots on the ground to do the follow-up that we needed. To kind of put it together. So that was that. The decision kind of made itself in the end.
Why don't you think things worked out in terms of having enough funding to continue in the race?
Well, it was really noisy. I think, as everybody knows, there were so many candidates. And, you know, I heard from just so many people that, look, we're not getting involved. We got to let this shake out some more. You know, we're not giving all these candidates, and, you know, and then some would give to, you know, a couple key people that they knew, or two or three of the top people that they knew, or if they were senator in a state, they would get money from donors because they were sitting senators. But for a guy like me from Youngstown, Ohio, I didn't have the New York, the Boston, the New Jersey, the California fundraising opportunity. Plus, I was a dark horse from the beginning. So it just, I didn't have the wherewithal to pull it together.
I think maybe Pete Buttigieg is somebody who has perhaps a similar profile to you, being from the industrial Midwest, more moderate than some of the more progressive or left candidates in the race. Like, why do you think he has been relatively successful up until this point?
Well, I think, he has a good network from, you know, where he went to school and all of that. And I think that helped him. And then he got in before me, too, which I think was really important. You know, I've got a wife and three kids, and they're back in Ohio and they're young. And, you know, so that was kind of what I was thinking about, really trying to figure out, you know, leaving that situation and, you know, having my wife having to deal with that, you know, like real world stuff. And so I didn't really decide that I was going to take the leap until April. And at that point, I think, you know, Mayor Pete had been out there and, he's a very compelling candidate and he's a great guy. And so he, you know, began connecting with people. And I think that was, you know, to his advantage and to my disadvantage.
You didn't meet the DNC donor or polling thresholds for the third and fourth debates. How much of an effect did that have on your campaign?
Oh, it was very detrimental because, you know, a couple of things. I mean, one, you know, you got to be on the stage because in donors' minds, the debate stage became like the clearing out process, fair or unfair. And people's minds are like, okay, we're not seeing you on the debate stage. We're not going to give you money. And so that, you know, I think that hurt people like me. And then the other thing is like you get better with every debate, you know, like anything. So my first debate was okay. I thought my second debate was a lot better than my first debate. And being able to do 3, 4, 5, I think I could have really, you know, gotten people's attention over time. And I think that, you know, because people were, and it was my bet from the beginning, industrial Midwest, Trump country, blue collar candidate, generational change, could definitely win Wisconsin, Michigan, Ohio, and Western Pennsylvania. You know, to not have that opportunity was really hurtful to me because I didn't have the money to stay in. So you're reliant on those kind of opportunities to just kind of keep you in the game until you can get to the end.
You said fair or unfair with regards to those DNC thresholds. Do you think that those thresholds made sense or were fair? How would you maybe have done things differently?
Well, I think we should have a, you know, we should have a family conversation about them, you know, when this is all said and done, because I do think that it limited the dark horse opportunities, you know, the Jimmy Carters, the Bill Clintons, the people that could come out of nowhere that aren't, you know, coming from the big media markets. I don't think you want to take that away. I mean, that really in a lot of ways has been the secret sauce for Democrats. When we get really stuck, we get this insurgent candidate from somewhere that we don't suspect, Georgia, Arkansas. I was, you know, hoping Youngstown, Ohio. And so I don't think there was any malice there. I just don't, you know, I don't think it's probably the best way. I thought we should have probably done, you know, three debates with seven people. In the first debate, I got 7 minutes and I didn't speak for the first like 40 minutes. So, you know, and when you take a step back and you're like, the people want to hear about not necessarily the candidates they already know, they want to hear from the candidates they don't know.
Taking a step back a little bit, why did you run for president in the first place?
Well, two things. I mean, I've been in Congress 17 years, and I believe I have developed an agenda that could, you know, transform our country and really plug in the forgotten communities that have been left behind into the global economy, and figuring out ways to make automation lead to investment in these communities. I had a very progressive agenda around our K-12 education with, you know, social and emotional learning in the schools and, you know, getting healthy food in the schools. I had a really transformational agenda around agriculture and promoting regenerative agriculture to really boost up rural communities. I thought we could have had a tremendous opportunity to go into rural America and talk about, you know, new ways of farming that can capture carbon and help farmers make money, closing the skills gap, the future technologies, you know, really having a comprehensive industrial and a technological policy in the United States. I mean, we had all that. I mean, I was super excited about the agenda, which is what kept me going throughout the 7 months. I just loved talking about these things that I had been working on in Congress for 17 years. They're backed by data and science and all the rest. Healing vets with yoga and meditation, like literally healing them without all these prescription drugs. And so that was the fuel behind it. But then the reason I ran was I thought I was the best person to beat Donald Trump. You know, it was the agenda, absolutely 1,000%. But I also thought that we need to nominate someone who can beat Trump. And I still think I was the best person.
Why do you think you're the best person to beat Donald Trump?
Well, one is the states that we need to win are literally my sweet spot. I mean, you know, I've been in Congress 17 years, a blue collar district, Northeast Ohio, like Western PA, Ohio, Michigan, Wisconsin, you know, industrial Midwest, Indiana, you know, those are my people, you know, white, black, brown, working class people from the industrial Midwest. It's how I grew up. It's my family. They're my friends. And, you know, I've traveled to Michigan and campaigned for Hillary and Wisconsin and campaigned for Hillary. Always got a super good response. Same in Iowa. You know, those are people that I can really deeply connect with and I think move back into, you know, our party. And again, the agenda that I'm talking to you about, you know, how do we invest into these forgotten communities? You know, I think is exciting. But lastly, and I think most importantly, when you're talking about a head-to-head against Donald Trump, like he lied to my constituents. Like he came to Ohio. He said, don't sell your house. He said he was going to bring manufacturing back. And we've seen with General Motors closing plants, moving production to Mexico, coal jobs are down. You know, it's like he lied to my people. So who's the best person to call him out on that, on Foxconn, on Carrier, on General Motors, on income inequality is still bad, on the budget deficits and all this stuff? It would be me. Where's the infrastructure bill that you promised $1.5 trillion? You said you were going to expand health care. You're kicking people off the rolls. I don't think there's anybody better to make that case than me. And that's what I felt, which was the final decision of why I thought I should get in.
Do you think there's anybody in the race who still represents that message from your point of view?
Yeah, I think there's probably a couple in there. You know, I think Biden just generally, because of his persona, you know, represents that point of view. I think actually, I think Andrew Yang, coincidentally enough, I think talks about the structural economic issues in the country as far as the problem, probably better than anybody else. I don't necessarily agree with his solution, but I think he articulates that better than anybody else. And I think Mayor Pete does a nice job on those particular issues.
So allow me to ask, who are you endorsing for the Democratic nomination?
Nobody yet. I'm going to, you know, we're just kind of
catching. Oh, come on. You don't want to do it right here, right now?
You know, this is the fourth interview I've done today, and everyone said the exact same thing. Are you sure you don't want to do it right now on this show? So I'm sorry.
So I guess it's between Biden, Buttigieg, and Yang. Is that fair enough to assume?
No, not necessarily. I mean, I really like Kamala Harris. Her and I, you know, had spent some time together on the campaign trail, and I really, really like her a lot. I think she's a compelling candidate. So, you know, we're just going to kind of keep our options open right now and see where it goes.
All right. So I want to get into a little bit more about the Democratic strategy for the upper Midwest in a bit. But on the topic of your campaign, so you explained kind of what your message was and why you thought you had a good case for Democrats and the American public. But, you know, we have some pretty wonky listeners. We like the details. So can you allow us to peek behind the curtain a little bit and share your electoral strategy with us? The nuts and bolts of, like, how did you actually think you were going to win this nomination as a member of the House? Obviously, only twice in history and never in the modern era has somebody gone from the House to the presidency. How are you going to make this happen on the ground?
Well, the concept was most voters in the Democratic primary want to beat Donald Trump. So who's the person who could best beat Donald Trump? That's the backdrop. Also, we want, I think most Democrats were kind of longing for maybe a generational change too. And so that was part of the general consensus in my mind about, you know, how we could persuade voters to come my way and the other things we mentioned too. But from a nuts and bolts perspective, you know, the strategy as it was developing became, we're going to retail this thing. And we're gonna do it the way I ran for Congress, you know, and how you get elected, how Bill Clinton got elected, how Jimmy Carter got elected. You go into the early states. We were posting up in New Hampshire and South Carolina to try to move the needle.
Why New Hampshire and South Carolina if your bid is kind of for a message that resonates with the Midwest?
Well, I think because that message resonates anywhere. You know, it's about who can win the Midwest states in the general, but it's also about that working class message was just as effective for me in Manchester, New Hampshire, and some of the mill towns around Manchester as it was in Greenville, South Carolina, in Columbia, South Carolina, as it was in certain areas in Iowa.
So I wanted to ask you about a specific part of your electoral strategy. Probably as you're familiar, last year, The Intercept reported that when you were considering your 2020 run, you were hoping to win the yoga vote. So what is the yoga vote?
Well, it's, you know, part of it's another way to describe it is like Whole Food moms, you know, people who primarily in the suburbs. It's more of a general election play, I think, more than anything. But activating those people who are into yoga, which is, you know, 40 million people in the country, which is not insignificant, people who are into, you know, contemplative practices. I will tell you, like, towards the end of the campaign, there was a what's called mindful communication program that they have at New Hampshire Technical Institute. They had a huge conference there about mindful communication, and I spoke there. Literally walked out of there with 20 volunteers. Who were teachers and nurses and social workers, but who believe in kind of mindfulness practices and everything else. Look, I mean, when you think about it, the number one issue in the country is trauma, you know, trauma-informed care in our schools. There's addiction issues, you know, issues around mental health, huge issues everywhere that no one's talking about. And so when I talk about yoga vote, in a sense, it's like, you're talking about mental health promotion. You're talking about a broken food system and how you want to fix it, and plays into the regenerative agriculture piece. Like, that is like the new message that I think can pull a lot of suburban voters into the Democratic Party if we can carve out that part of our agenda.
I mean, you talked about Whole Foods moms, and I looked at the International Journal of Yoga Therapy, and so they described the segment of the population that does yoga. They say, quote, "The practice of yoga is largely dominated by whites, women, those with higher education and incomes, and young and middle-aged adults who represent a very narrow segment of the population." You know, this is not definite or prescriptive in terms of who does yoga, but why focus on that segment of the population?
Well, I don't think it was a focus. I think it was a part of a coalition.
Including
who else? The focus was, well, working class people, you know, I mean, the blue collar workers.
I guess that's interesting. How do you tie those two together in a way, like Whole Food moms? And then, you know, you're from Youngstown, Ohio. You represent Youngstown, Ohio. Where did you see the ability to create a coalition between those two groups?
Well, it's around competition. You know, the broader theme is like, how are we, one, going to fix the economy? And then how are we going to compete against China? And you look at our test scores, you look at the amount of money we spend on chronic disease. It's like $3.5 trillion a year because of the broken food system and food deserts and all of these other things. And so, you know, the lack of prevention, the lack of social and emotional health and development for our young people. You look at our math and science scores, for example. Like, how are you going to compete in a global economy
when I'm building electric vehicles, AI, machine learning, additive manufacturing, 3D printing,
without a lot of really smart STEM students graduating from our high schools? And so how do you get test scores up? Well, you switch the question from how do you get test scores up to how do you take care of our kids? And when you promote these kind of things around social and emotional health, what you see is social and emotional learning programs that have been implemented in schools across the country show an 11 percentile increase in test scores. And so, you know, you could be a Whole Foods mom, but you can be a working class mom too. And you care about, you know, what your kids are eating at school and how they're doing and what's their mental health state. I mean, you see the teen suicide rate. I mean, these are really big problems that there's no silver bullet. But so that working class mom who may work at General Motors has the same desire for their kids to be competitive in this crazy global economy that we're in. And so that's how you tie it all together.
Although, you know, one thing I kind of think about when you're describing this, the main group that you discussed at the beginning was the Midwest. And you represent, of course, a district that is about 83% white. When we talk about the yoga vote or Whole Foods moms, that also seems like a white demographic. Of course, 40% of the Democratic primary electorate is people of color. How did you see people of color playing into this coalition between the Midwest, upper Midwest working class and the yoga vote?
Well, same. I mean, you know, schools, developing our neighborhoods. You know, when you look at the endorsements I got in South Carolina, you know, you go there. I was going to churches, spending time with leaders, you know, having real, honest conversations with them. And, you know, you look at the pastors that I was able to pick up in South Carolina, almost all of my endorsements down there were leaders in the African American community. So, you know, we were making some real headway, again, by doing retail politics, looking people in the eye, listening to what their needs are. And so, you know, some of my best precincts that I run in are in Youngstown, Ohio, you know, in the African American community. And Youngstown, a lot of people didn't know this, again, tried really hard to get this to break through, but you know, it's over 50% people of color, and I think 43, 44, 45% African American. And I do extremely well in those precincts in Youngstown. So I have a really good connection within the African American community that translated when I talked about my endorsements in South Carolina. We talked about economic issues, which are really important. You know, of course, African Americans are concerned about criminal justice reform and other issues, but they also want economic development. They want a job. And so when I'm talking about electric vehicles, and I've said this a lot during the campaign, all of the things I laid out to you, electric vehicles, wind, solar, blah, blah, blah. And how do we steer those investments in the communities of color? How do we steer those investments to the communities that have been left behind? Old steel, old auto, old coal, you know, old rubber. You know, the growth from the new economy needs to be steered towards those people who have been left behind in the new economy.
I want to talk to you a little bit more broadly about the current direction of the Democratic Party. But first, today's podcast is brought to you by ZipRecruiter. Hiring can be a slow process. Here's a story. Cafe Altura's COO, Dylan Miskowitz, needed to hire a director of coffee for his organic coffee company, but he was having trouble finding qualified applicants. So he switched to ZipRecruiter. ZipRecruiter doesn't depend on candidates finding you. It finds them for you. Its technology identifies people with the right experience and invites them to apply to your job, so you get qualified candidates fast. Dylan posted his job on ZipRecruiter and said he was impressed by how quickly he had great candidates apply. He also used ZipRecruiter's candidate rating feature to filter his applicants so he could focus on the most relevant ones. And that's how Dylan found his new director of coffee in just a few days. With results like that, it's no wonder 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a qualified candidate within the first day. Try ZipRecruiter for free at this web address, ZipRecruiter.com/538. That's ZipRecruiter.com/538. The numbers, not the letters. ZipRecruiter.com/538. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. All right, we're back. And I want to ask you generally, what do you think about the current direction of the Democratic Party? Open-ended question there.
Yeah, I think both parties right now are not necessarily popular. I think the brands are not necessarily popular. People are pretty down on politics. They paint everybody with a broad brush. And I think there's an opportunity for us as Democrats to hit the reset button and put together a real creative, innovative, exciting agenda for the next version of America.
You mentioned that both of the parties aren't popular and the polling backs you up there. What do you think the Democratic Party has done in particular that has made it unpopular? For example, I've heard you talk about forgetting the working class. Why do you think that it's forgotten the working class, or at least the perception has been that it's forgotten the working class?
I think social media has driven a lot of the conversations. And, you know, the people that are working swing shifts, they're waitresses, you know, they're not on social media. And so, you know, the kids that are K through 12, you know, they're not necessarily most of them aren't on social media, and they're certainly not on social media around politics. And so the agenda is not economic. And so, you know, when you're talking about, I'll just give you an example. Many people in our party, our nominees, some of the people competing for the nomination have said they're going to ban fracking. Okay. Now, this is the natural gas. Are you familiar with it?
Yep. Okay. I am from upstate New York, so I'm pretty familiar.
Yeah, you got it. So that is, and I'm sure it was very well received on social media. Now, if you grow up where I come from, there is a $5 billion natural gas plant in western Pennsylvania. It has about 6,000 or 7,000 union workers who are making anywhere from $80,000 to $120,000 a year in western PA. They're going to do another one in eastern Ohio, and it'll be very similar with regard to workers, all union. And so these folks here, that you're going to take their job when you're talking about, you know, a complete ban on fracking across the board. And my concern is that a Democratic Party that is not talking to those working class people is the party that's going to end up putting Pennsylvania in play, have no chance at winning Ohio. And the conversation in the union halls, or in the building construction union halls, are going to be that the Democrats want to take our job. And then the other piece with the single payer healthcare, we're going to force you in to get rid of your private insurance and go into this system. like those, all the while you want to do free health insurance for undocumented workers. Now, I think undocumented workers should be able to get health care, but they should have to pay for it like everybody else does. So you put those two or three things together, like those all may be popular on social media, and they completely disconnect you from working class people in the very states that we need to win. And so my concern is that those workers, instead of thinking you want to make healthcare cheaper, more affordable, and get prescription drug prices down, the conversation is now about how you're going to take away their healthcare and also provide it free for somebody else. And where we should be saying we want to get you good paying jobs. And I said this a million times, that I don't want to talk about $15 an hour. I want to talk about $30 and $40 an hour. Well, those workers are making $30, $40, $50 an hour with really good benefits and good retirement in the natural gas industry. So, and what complicates this is that these workers who are now working in natural gas, like, they were the heroes 5 years ago because natural gas was displacing coal. Right. And so it was like, this is a great bridge. It's jobs. You can run power plants off of this stuff. These guys are making $100,000 a year. And now all of a sudden they're the bad guy. And the Democrats want to take their job and take their health insurance and give free stuff to other people.
You mentioned social media. You know, you're involved in politics on a daily basis. There has to be more to it than that. Like, why has the Democratic Party moved to the left on all of these issues? Do you think it's simply social media?
Well, it's been the weakening of the unions. The party has moved to the coasts primarily. You know, the money on the coasts has driven, you know, a lot of the agenda. And so, you know, this is the reason Trump won, is that we've lost that connection in a lot of ways to the worker. And so that's, you know, part of it, that the loss of manufacturing with no, which is why I'm trying to say and have tried to say, like, we've got to have, I kept talking about this chief manufacturing officer, right? We've got to have an agenda that speaks to those people, that you get what they're doing. You get what they want to do. We need to start making things again. Yeah, it's not going to be steel from 1950. It's going to be electric vehicles and charging stations. But there's a hell of a lot of opportunity here for these people to have a good job well into the future. They need to see the Democrats as the people bringing those jobs.
When it comes to connecting with the working class, I'm sure you've seen this data as well, but exit polls from 2016 show that Hillary Clinton won voters earning under $50,000 a year by 12 points, right? Beating Donald Trump with a double-digit margin in terms of working class voters. I mean, does it suggest that there's more at play here than just economics? I know that there has been a debate amongst analysts and within the Democratic Party since 2016 about whether there are cultural grievances, racial animus, et cetera, also at play. Do you buy any of that, or do you think it's all about working class economics?
Well, it's complicated, as you know. It's a little bit of everything. But, you know, obviously there were racial elements, no question. Anti-woman sentiment in some quarters, but you also saw a lot of African Americans not go out to vote at all. And so to me, you know, when you see working class whites go to Trump and you see African American working class people not showing up at the numbers we need them to show up in to win the election, then that tells me we weren't speaking in a very robust way to the working class. And Trump co-opted a message around trade in the industrial Midwest. You know, he kept saying, you know, Bill Clinton passed NAFTA, and, you know, you go to my area and we lost tens of thousands of jobs and, you know, hundreds of factories in the industrial Midwest around after NAFTA, where, like, you know, yeah, now it's automation, but people remember the factory, like the company going over the border to Mexico, building a factory and shipping the product back. And just one story I told at the debate where my cousin had to literally unbolt a machine from the factory floor, you know, put it in a box and ship it to China, you know, and they would go to Mexico and train workers that would eventually take their job. And so Trump was able to go in and kind of co-opt that message. Now, the opportunity we have in this election that we didn't have in the last election is that he hasn't delivered for those people, which is why the worker now is super disoriented about what the future holds, which means we've got to have a plan for bringing back middle-class jobs. And we've got to do what Bill Clinton did in 92. You know, Carville used to say, you got to explain it to them. Like, you got to explain to people how you're going to get electric vehicles and batteries and this and that, and how those, that growth is going to go into these, you know, older communities that have been left behind. And that's, you know, to me, that's the agenda that plays in both South Carolina and New Hampshire. The industrial Midwest.
Progressives within your party would argue that the people who are doing that explaining are people like Warren and Sanders, who have a more populist message and in some cases support the positions that you described as unpopular for working class people in Western Pennsylvania and Ohio. Do you think that those progressive candidates are on the right track?
I think they have identified the problem. I just think that, you know, those voters who are, you know, paying health care, working hard to pay for their own health care, or work in the manufacturing industry, I don't hear some of the candidates talking about what are we going to do. And I've said this during the campaign, it's like we're talking about Band-Aids. That, and some I agree with, right? What are we talking about here? We're talking about healthcare, childcare, pensions, you know, affordability for college and all of this stuff. Why are we talking about all those? Because those are band-aids to the main problem. And the main problem is people aren't making enough money at the jobs that they're working at right now. And so what are the industries of the future that are going to pay 30, 40, 50 bucks an hour? And not all of them are going to be college degrees. And there's a huge skills gap. So how do we close that? But I think painting the picture of electric vehicles, you know, charging stations, batteries, all of this stuff, and rewarding companies who are moving in that direction and taking care of their workers with maybe lower tax rates and other things, like, that to me paints a picture as opposed to what Medicare for All means, or what the concept of, you know, universal childcare means, or whatever. It's like people would rather make 40 bucks an hour and their spouse make 20 or 30 or 40 bucks an hour, and they'll pay for their own childcare. Don't get me wrong, I'm not saying we shouldn't help people who need it. What I'm saying is we keep talking, the whole conversation is around the Band-Aids that we want to put on the problem, as opposed to how do we fix the structural problem.
So you've expressed a lot of concern about the Democratic Party in the wake of 2016. It was part of why you challenged Nancy Pelosi in the leadership election back in 2016. You've explained a lot of reasons why you think that the party may still not be on the right track. Are you still pretty pessimistic?
I think there's an opportunity. I mean, elections are obviously what they are. I'm more optimistic because, as I said a few minutes ago, like, Trump was coming in as a businessman with no record, really, of economic development or policies. He's been in now for 2.5 years, and he lied to a bunch of people in the industrial Midwest. So I'm optimistic that we have an opportunity to pull him back. You know, our base is very energized. So is his. But to be determined. I'm definitely more optimistic than I was after Trump got elected. But we really have to play our cards right. I mean, we've got to be smart here. And you know, we talk a lot about revolutions and all of this. The revolution I want in the United States is to get rid of Donald Trump. I think that in and of itself is a complete intellectual, emotional revolution, spiritual, cultural revolution in the United States if we remove him and begin rebuilding the country, healing the country. And so we've just got to be really smart. And I'm being honest. You know, I'm just, my whole campaign, I was like, I'm just going to be honest. I'm going to say what I feel, and I'm going to give this perspective from a place like Youngstown, Ohio. Now, I thought people would, you know, gravitate to that if I could get the message out enough, and they would say, yeah, this is the perfect guy to beat Trump. But I figured if it doesn't work out, I at least want everybody to know that in this region of the country that I know best, this is how people are hearing what you're saying. When you say ban fracking, they're hearing you're going to take your job. When you say we're going to force everybody into, you know, a Medicare for all program, they're hearing you're going to raise my taxes and you're going to force me out of my health insurance that I like. You see what I'm saying? So my role in this is to just make sure that we go into this race with eyes wide open. The voters that we need most have got to really hear a message that speaks to them and their economic interests, whether those economic interests are prescription drug costs or their job or their wages. And if we do that in a really aspirational way around making sense of the new economy for everybody and transforming education, we can win. And I think we could win big. But my concern is we've got to have a nominee who can beat him. And not just that, but have a nominee who can go into North Carolina and Iowa and South Carolina and Kentucky and Kansas and help us win these Senate races too. That's going to be key for us.
All right. Well, we'll leave it there. Thank you so much for joining me today.
Yeah, it was great. Thank you.
I've been speaking with Congressman Tim Ryan from Ohio's 13th Congressional District. There you have it, another exit interview in the bag. Hopefully we'll have the opportunity to speak to some more previous Democratic candidates as they exit the race, as I mentioned, 18 left. Anyway, my name is Galen Druk. Tony Chow is in the control room. Our intern is Jake Arlo. You can get in touch by emailing us at podcasts@538.com. You can also, of course, tweet at us with questions or comments. If you're a fan of the show, leave us a rating or a review in the Apple Podcast Store or tell someone about us. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you soon.